So when Dave and I agreed to do this series, one of the things that we made as one of our axioms was that we wanted to present the character of God in a way that was practical. And so sometimes we were able to weave practicality through both messages. Other times, we sometimes front-loaded our sermons on the first part and then tried to make more of a connection that was more practical in the second part. And as you know, last week I started on the goodness of God. And so the question is, what was I going to do this week? In John Wenham's towering work on the goodness of God, he writes this in his introduction. He says, look at the goodness of God. When we look at the world of solid reality as seen in history and in the contemporary world, things seem far from good. There is the long continuing tale of man's inhumanity to man. Every age has known oppression and torture and the sighing of prisoners. Spain has had its Inquisition, Britain its Atlantic slave trade, Germany its gas chambers, Russia its Siberian labor camps. A world torn by war now lives under the protective threat of nuclear bombs. But it is a world still swept by fear and lust and greed and racial tension. It is a world where the ordinary man feels he's the pawn of an irresistible, impersonal force which govern his life. Is it conceivable that a kindly providence of unlimited power presides over it all? How can God look on in silence as the bombs rain down on defenseless cities, as widows and orphans cry to heaven for protection? How can God endure the age-long grinding poverty of so many multitudes? Further than this, human wickedness does not by any means appear to be the sole cause of human misery. Babies are born deformed, both physically and mentally. They inherit diseases. They inherit tendencies to insanity. Why does he allow apparently purposeless torture to the sick, producing at times not purification, but agonized bitterness? Why does he allow one of his faithful servants to endure torment on the borderline between sanity and insanity? Is this world of preying animals, of parasites, of viruses, of bacteria, really the work of a good creator? Is it God's design which allows a quantum of energy from outer space to cause some hideous mutation in an unborn child? People find themselves in a world of earthquake and typhoon, in a world accident prone, where bereavement and inconsolable grief may strike without warning. It is a world united only in expectation of death, a world to many without purpose or hope, against which there is a deep, despairing hatred. And then he writes his book. I think on Wednesday I must have written two completely different sermons trying to think how to give you the counter argument. Last week we talked solely about the goodness of God, and I said in my sermon that in the week following I would give you some of the arguments against the goodness of God. Couldn't do it. There is something about what we've all been through the past 2 years, and there is something I force myself to watch BBC World News. I refuse to hide with Seinfeld reruns the terrible thing that's happening in Europe. I simply refuse. And as hard as it is to watch, I think I have a responsibility. And through all of that, I just couldn't bring myself to stand here this morning and start recounting all the different ways in which people hate God and don't think he's a good God. So I scratch in my head, what in the world do I preach on? Because I am stuck. I did announce it was on the goodness of God, so I can't just change that. My eyes caught a book on the shelf in front of me by Haddon Robinson. And he had written a little book to theologians on the book of Ecclesiastes. And I remembered what a favorite book it was of my father's. My father often preached on two books in particularly. One was on Jonah. He was known in many parts of the world for preaching a series on Jonah. The second was on Ecclesiastes. And I still had some of my notes from a course that I took with my dad 40 years ago. It's a long time the older you get. And as I began to put that together in my mind, I thought, now there's an interesting way to preach the goodness of God. So let me go there this morning. Let me preach to you the entire book of Ecclesiastes. I hope I can inspire you sometime in the next little while to sit down with this interesting book and have a look at it. I want to borrow from this other preacher. After all, that's how Solomon introduces the book. The word for preacher in Hebrew is the word koheleth, and it's the word for the man who addresses an assembly. The corresponding word in the Greek is ecclesiasticus, and that's where the book's name comes from. It's a very curious book. The only problem with this ancient preacher is that many people read what he writes and they feel he's backslidden. They feel that here's a guy who wrote this and he wasn't right with God himself. That there's something that he hasn't sorted out. They see him as kind of a wolf in sheep's clothing. And a not particularly convincing sheep at that. Ancient rabbis particularly had a great deal of difficulty with the book of Ecclesiastes. And many of them felt it should not be in the library of inspiration, and they simply refused to preach on it at all. Even those who believe this book is a unity cannot agree to what the message is all about. And yet it seems to me to be completely untenable and completely illogical that the Spirit of God would give us 12 chapters simply to listen to the musings of a naturalist or a rationalist. If I want that, I can just go to any campus and talk to one of the students there, or sit on an airplane and engage in conversation with whoever gets stuck beside me. This book connects on a much different level. It speaks the language of the frustrated, the language of the angry, the language of the hurt, the confused, the anxious, the despairing. It speaks the language of people who feel hopeless in this world and would even contemplate taking their own lives because the world is so tedious, so lonely, so repetitively boring. Trouble is, the way that I often feel about my life and life in general is not God's way or God's truth. They're simply feelings that I have and that many of you would share. I find that the view of this book is difficult to accept because the preacher himself says that he feels at times it's not right what he's thinking, and yet he can't help himself to express the way that he feels. In the last chapter, He goes and says, not only was the preacher wise, but he also imparted knowledge to the people. He pondered and he searched out and he set in order many proverbs. The preacher searched for right words. What he wrote was upright and true. The words of the wise are like goads. They're collected sayings that are firmly embedded nails given by a shepherd. A goad, a prod, a cattle prod that you use to move things along. That's how he felt about some of the things that he wrote. If we take the preacher's words at face value, he says that there is in this book a kind of truth that can hold us very stable, a kind of truth that can move us to God. The question is, what is the message of the preacher in Ecclesiastes? We can approach this book like we often approach books. There's the preface, the prelude. Some of you flip right to the end of the book to see what it's like, and you want to know what the end is. And then, of course, if you like both the beginning and the end, you read the middle. So what is the prelude? When we approach the reading of Ecclesiastes in this way, we find that he's going to tell us what it's all about. The prelude of the book is found in chapter 1, verse 2. Meaningless, meaningless, says the preacher, utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless. The King James Version picks that up, and some people think it's more poetic to say vanity of vanities. All is vanity. Dad, through his extensive research in Near Eastern languages, in the end came up with his own translation, which he said was closer to the truth of what the preacher meant through that Hebrew expression. And so Dad would say, transitoriousness of transitoriousness. Trouble is, no one ever picked that up and made it popular on their fridge, because it's typical, like my dad, it's too much of a mouthful. Might be accurate, but who wants to say that? But that's what he said the word really ultimately means. It's all the stuff that is transitory. There's nothing permanent. It's always changing. And because there's nothing changing, there's nothing that feels solid. And if you live your life in a bowl of jello with just squishy concepts and squishy ideas and squishy palatable stuff that you can't get your teeth into, then it feels like that. Utterly meaningless. Some people are fond of saying that the book of Ecclesiastes is never referred to in the New Testament. I'm not sure of that at all, because Paul in Romans 8 says, for the creation was subjected to frustration, not only by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it in hope. Paul echoes the idea that the way creation is bound right now within a framework of sinfulness, there is a frustration that can be equated with meaninglessness. He's talking about all of creation. And there's at least one place in which Koheleth and the Apostle Paul agree, and that is that life can appear futile and meaningless and hard. When you go to the end, you get to 12:13, and Koheleth says, now all has been heard. Here's the conclusion of the matter. Fear God, keep His commandments, for that's the duty of all mankind. And curiously, the conclusion is utterly orthodox. Really doesn't need any biblical support. Although 2 Corinthians 5:10 comes to mind, we all stand before one day the judgment seat of Christ and we'll all give an account for the things done in the body. So the conclusion of the book, after the prelude, of vain, futile, and meaningless. The conclusion is, have reverence and fear God, listen and obey what he has to say. Those two things seem incompatible. Then you get to the middle, and he has all kinds of interesting things to say. There is a major emphasis. Person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. This too I see is from the hand of God. I know there's nothing better than for people to be happy and do good while they live, that everyone may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all of their work. This is the gift of God. Or in 3:22, I saw there's nothing better than for a person to enjoy their work because that's his lot, for who will bring him to see what will happen after that? Or 5:18, then I realized that it's good and proper for a person to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his toilsome labor under the sun during the few days of life that God has given him. That's his lot. 8:15, and so I commend the enjoyment of life because nothing is better for a person under the sun than to eat and drink and be glad. Then joy will accompany him in the work of all the days of the life God has given him under the sun. And finally, in 9:7, he says, go, eat your food with gladness, drink your wine with a joyful heart, for it's now that God favors what you do. Always be clothed in white, always anoint your head with oil, enjoy life with your wife whom you love all the days of this meaningless life that God has given you under the sun. Isn't that lovely? So there we go again. Premise, vain, futile, meaningless. Conclusion of the book, fear God, keep his commandments. In between, like the recurring notes of a symphony, eat, drink, and be merry. When Koheleth says that life is vain, life is futile, he doesn't mean it's not worth living. And that's one of the strange things to figure out as you read the book. It's not an anti-life book. It is that the reality of life may indeed feel like futility and meaningless and vainfulness, transitoriousness. However, it's still a life worth living. And that's where it's such a curious book. He says that try as we will, you and I will never figure it out. The preacher is looking for the key that will unlock the mystery of life. He discovers that God is the keeper of that key, and he never gives it to us. Search all that you want. Try as we will, we're never going to figure it out. God has made everything beautiful in its time. He's also set eternity in the hearts of men, yet they cannot fathom what God has done from the beginning to the end. Koheleth wants us to understand that the thing that separates human beings from animals is that we take a long view of the past, and we take even a longer view of the future. And it's part of being human that we want to see the whole thing together and complete. We are not animals. We don't just live in a 3-second moment. And by putting eternity in our hearts, it makes it tough for us because we want to see the end. And we want to see how everything that came before the end fits. It needs to go together. It's like being sort of addicted to crossword puzzles and yet having a limited vocabulary. There's got to be answers. The clues sort of make, but you can never get it. It never fits. The crossword is never done. It's never complete. We can't get all the squares filled in. And so he says the same thing. Chapter 7, when times are good, be happy. When times are bad, consider. Think about it. God has made the one as well as the other. But a person cannot discover anything about their future. Unless you're kind of a sour person, this is kind of easy advice to follow. It's the way life ought to be. But when times are bad, we all start asking questions. That's natural. It's perfectly understandable. The trouble is, you're not going to figure it out. And the more you think about it, the more you're going to get lost in the, oh man, this is hopeless, futile, meaningless, transitory. We can't put it together. And then Koheleth gives all kinds of other examples. Some are humorous, some are deadly serious. I've seen another evil under the sun. It weighs heavily on men. God gives man wealth and positions and honor so that he lacks nothing that his heart desires, but he doesn't enable him to enjoy them. A stranger enjoys them instead. So much that's there, and yet you can't have it. At the wedding last night, they put out the desserts. Trouble is, oh, did they look good? They were too rich for me. Kind of sad. When I was young and lean and healthy, all we could afford was Hamburger Helper. Now I get along in life, and eventually our teeth won't chew what we really want. Cholesterol won't allow it. Digestion can't handle it. It's all futile. It's meaningless. Or he talks of ...9/11, I hadn't done that one yet. Race is not to the swift or the battle to the strong, nor does food come to the wise or wealth to the brilliant or favor to the learned. Time and chance happen to them all. Chuck Swindoll was having a catered dinner with some dignitaries, and he was seated next to a very famous investment broker. So Chuck leans over to the investment broker and says, "Do you mind just telling me, in your vast experience, what have you learned?" The investment broker said, "I've learned that some of the stupidest people in this city are the wealthiest, and that some of the smartest have gone completely bankrupt." That's Ecclesiastes 9:11. The race is not to the swift or the battle to the strong. We think it's that way. How many times this past Winter Olympics, just a couple of weeks ago, did I hear that a Canadian was favored, had all the world championship record times, then gets in the Olympics and comes fourth? The fastest is not always first. The strongest doesn't always win the battle. Time and chance happen to them all. It's not fair. The wise man has eyes in his head while a fool walks in darkness, but I came to realize that the same fate overtakes them both, and I thought in my heart, the fate of the fool will overtake me also. What then do I gain by being wise? And I said in my heart, this too is meaningless. The thing that makes life most difficult is the reality of death. And so Koheleth tackles it a number of times. And one of the things that we all realize is that death seems to keep very sloppy appointment books. You and I, a couple of months ago, talked about a missionary couple, I think, that lost a child just driving on the way. I don't even remember all the details, but again, it just kind of hits you. Meanwhile, many of us know or have loved ones who don't know us anymore. They're sitting in a hospital bed waiting for death, but it never comes or hasn't come yet. Death seems to have lost their address, yet others are gone in an instant. Koheleth says, I hated all the things I toiled for under the sun because I must lead them to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether you'll be a wise man or a fool, yet you'll have control over all the work into which I've poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless. I work and I work and I work and I build my empire, I build my farm, I build my business, I put all this effort into it, but in the end I'm going to die and I'm going to leave it to someone else, and who knows if the person even deserves it, whether they're a fool or not. How do we explain that in a generation or two, most of the people living on the earth then will not even remember your name? And if you haven't felt that, you haven't lived long enough yet, or you haven't thought deeply enough yet. But yet, many young people today face that, and they choose suicide. Because they run straight to the end, say it's pointless anyway, no, and then they decide to end it here rather than just wait till then, because they say there's nothing going to change in between. Preachers looking for a key that will unlock the mystery and make sense of it all. And as you read it through, you find that he comes up with some possible answers to the mystery of life. One, he says, nature. Very nice, very pretty. But then he says, the sun rises, the sun sets, it hurries back to where it rises. Does it all over again. The wind blows to the south, then it turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. Now it's north again, now it's south again, now it's east again, now it's west again. It's not new, there's only so many points on the compass. Wind's got to come from somewhere. All the streams flow into the sea, but the sea is never full. Why? Because it just evaporates, goes up in the clouds, rains down again, goes back into the river, goes back to the... round and around and around and around. Somehow, this great cycle doesn't really give you an explanation for life at all. What about science? He says he looked at science. In verse 10, he says, is there anything of which one can say, look, hey, there's something new. No, it was already here long ago. It was here long before our time. I love when you start feeling like that. You could tell that that's a terrible feeling. That's the feeling of, I look, I made a new discovery, but is it really a new discovery if it's been here all the time? It's just maybe I'm the first person to discover the discovery, but it actually isn't a discovery because it was here. And so he just talks himself back into saying, everything's been here since the creation of the world. Yeah, that doesn't make my life terribly interesting. History. No one remembers the former generations, and even those yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow them. So I've become an expert in history. In the end, what does it matter? Historians can tell you what happened. Scientists can tell you how it happened. Nobody can tell you why it happened. Oh, there's a guy I want to learn something from. Philosophy and theology. For with much wisdom there comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. People claim to have the answers, but in the end, what is twisted can't be straightened, what is lacking cannot be counted. That's his philosophical conclusion. It's all messed up anyway, and nobody can figure it out. So what should we do in order to face up to the feelings of futility in life and the sometimes endless meaninglessness of life's merry-go-round? Maybe it's something you've pondered in the past. Maybe your life's been pretty good till now. I say now because I've been alive. How many years have I been alive, honey? 62? 3? 4? Really? That much? Oh, man. Seriously, though, in all the things that I've experienced in my 60-ish life, I don't know that I've ever encountered something as serious as what's going on in Europe right now. This makes everything pale in comparison. What do we do? Part of what he writes about, what irritates people, is when he talks about living it up. He just tells it like it is. That's certainly what some will do. And to a certain extent, it's what we can do. Or you can give up. Live it up or give up. But Koheleth does one other thing in the book, and he weaves it through very masterfully. And sometimes with a thread that some people don't think is strong enough, but it's there. And I want to close with this morning. The great truth that Ecclesiastes wants us to know. He wants us to know that believing that God is sovereign allows us to live with this mystery. He's not trying to come across as a cynic or a skeptic. He just wants to be realistic and allow for the fact that human beings have feelings, and those feelings aren't always wonderful. Because he says people who think their feelings are always going to be wonderful are lying, or they're on something all the time. And so as you read through the book, his faith keeps bubbling through in many places. There are several things that he believes about God, and one is that he believes God is sovereign. He says, God has made everything beautiful in its time. God has also set eternity in the hearts of people, yet they cannot fathom what God has done from the beginning to the end. Koheleth believes God is sovereign. He says, when times are happy, good, be happy. When times are bad, consider God has made the one as well as the other. Man can't discover anything about his future. He believes God is sovereign. He believes that even though he doesn't know the plot line, God does. And Paul does echo that. The verse that I already read you where he says that the whole creation is subject to vanity. Paul then quickly goes on at the end in verse 28, and he says, we know that God works all things together for good to them who love God, to them who are called according to this purpose. So Paul sees the seeming meaninglessness and vanity of life and the groaning of creation waiting for something that we don't have yet because we live in a sin-plagued world. But he looks to God who says, he's weaving this all. It's all a tapestry and it's going to come together. God's hand is on history. He controls it. He's sovereign. Trusting that God is good allows us to live with enjoyment. In the face of meaninglessness, futility, vanity of life, not only does Koheleth believe that God is sovereign, he believes that God is good. And so he says, I know there's nothing better for men than to be happy and to do good while they live, that everyone may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all his toil. This is the gift of God. Moreover, when God gives anyone wealth and possessions and enables them to enjoy them, to accept their lot, be happy in their work. This is a gift of God. Then he seldom reflects on the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with gladness of heart. When there's something to enjoy, enjoy it. When there is something good, receive it. Welcome it. Don't feel guilty about taking what a good God offers at various intervals. And praise and thanksgiving can keep at bay the gloom that comes if you only think about the negative. There's lots of negative, but if you center on it, think about it, wallow in it, never let it go, you will never be able to enjoy what he calls the good gifts of God. Praise and thanksgiving. How many sermons, how many times have we talked about the necessity? It's not just something that God wants from us. He says it's necessary for our souls or we will go bankrupt. Finally, he says, knowing that God is just allows us to live responsibly. He believes that God is just and holy and good. And so that's what he says in the conclusion. Now all has been heard, and here's the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of men and women. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. Live life to the hilt. Live it with abandon. But live it responsibly. You see, we're going to give an account to God for the good we've done and the good we've refused to do. We're going to stand at the judgment seat of Christ, judge for the good and evil in our lives. And because that's true, when we as Christians say abandon yourself to living well, it's not just do whatever you like, even the immoral stuff. No, it's live your life with abandon, with joy, but do it responsibly, because you are going to give an account. Pick and choose carefully. So what's the final answer to the mystery of life? This life that seems vain, seems futile, seems and is so transitory, and try as we will, he says we're never going to figure it out. However, you can live in the presence of a sovereign, good, and just God. Here's the conclusion I wrote down at the very end of the series of lectures that my father gave. Said, God does not give you answers, but he does give you himself. And he has said, in the complexities of life, I will never leave you, I will never forsake you. Therefore, we can say, what can a person do to me? But in the light of the perplexities and meaninglessness and vanity of life, you can trust the sovereign, good, and righteous God. And in that faith, you can trust what you cannot comprehend. You can step where you cannot see, and you can experience much of what you may never understand. And with Jesus, it's worth it. Somebody once asked Mrs. Einstein if she understood Professor Einstein's theory of relativity. She said, no, I don't understand the theory of relativity, but I do understand my husband, and that's all I need. We don't have to lose the relationship because we don't have the answers. Because we know the person who is the author and finisher of all questions and answers. I love that he says you can trust what you can't comprehend. I'm a horrible artist. I mean, worthy of greatness, horrible. like I'm in a category of my own, right? So when people would try and play that drawing indications game, right? I'm the last person picked for a team all the time, right? You know what I love to do as a kid? Trace. I love tracing. Remember tracing paper? You lay it down on top of something, and then you trace the line. I could come up with the most beautiful dinosaurs and cars and bears. Suddenly, I was an artist. You'd lift that off, and you'd color it in, you'd say, look. And my parents would say, oh, you traced that. They knew. The moment you move the tracing paper away from what you're trying to trace, you know what happens. It becomes fainter and fainter, and then you can't trace anymore. I love that line, to trust what I can't trace, comprehend. To step where you cannot see. I hate team building games that I used to have to go to. When we were working on what it takes to be administratively great. I hated those team building games with a passion. I especially hate when they put the blindfold on you and then they say just trust the person who's going to do something with you, but you know, you don't need to know what it is. You just need to learn to trust. I hated that game. I would always try and cheat and peek through the bottom of the mask. No way I trusted that person. Plus, I always thought it was going to be some beginning of a comedy sketch. You know, somebody was going to do something to me. To trust God that you step where you cannot see. And then it says at the end, and you will experience what you may never understand. There are so many experiences I do not understand, people. I don't have the answers. I simply have Jesus. That's all I got. And in the light of that, Koheleth urges us to live life anyway and make it worth living. He does say, you got food, enjoy it. Mysteries of life. A good God has given us this world. And there's a lot that's wrong with it. There's a lot that frightens us. And right now, there's an awful lot that makes me anxious. And I have to still put one foot in front of the other day after day and live my life as God asks of me, doing my duty, keeping my responsibilities to wife, to family, to friends. Doing what I can with the gifts that God has given me and praying about all the things that I cannot change. And then trust Him. Trust Him for every step and for every experience. It's all we got. That's what Koheleth writes about. A lot of people didn't appreciate him writing it that way. Read Ecclesiastes this week and find something encouraging. Let's bow in prayer.